Today is the 27th of August, 1999, and I'm interviewing Sir Oliver Napier. Thanks, Oliver, for taking the time.
Mm-hmm.
Just want to start by asking how you became involved in the party. I know you're a founding member, but if you could just go through some of the events that led up to the foundation of the party.
Yes, I think I can. I was a member of the Ulster Liberal Party,
mm-hmm.
Which I don't think anybody is now alive except me and one or two of us I've ever heard of, but it was a very small non-sectarian party, and I was a member of the executive of that party from about 1961 or two until 1969. I had a major argument with them, and it wasn't to do with policy so much as they just ran into various elections here and there, and when the election was over, their presence was no longer seen.
Mm-hmm.
And I said that if you wanted a political party, you had to build it on the ground, you had to have a local party organization, and you had to be known. And as a result of that, myself and three or four other people launched an organisation called the New Ulster Movement. And that was in February of 1969. And the idea of that was to be a political movement rather than a party, which would hopefully unite people simply for moderation in Northern Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
With a number of common principles. That New Ulster Movement subsequently became, with one or two other small organisations, that became the nucleus for the Alliance Party, which was formed in April of 1970. Because while it started off life as a movement, it became fairly clear that it was not, those members in it who were members of political parties were not able to influence the political parties they were in.
Mm-hmm.
And people like me, for example, I was expelled from the Liberal Party because of my association with the New Ulster Movement. So more and more people became politicised, and the New Ulster Movement effectively was the midwife of the Alliance Party. I said there were one or two other little organisations. There were a number of things called parliamentary organisations. There were about three or four of them, which had been formed ad hoc to fight for pro-O'Neill candidates in the 1969 Stormont election.
What was the objectives of the New Ulster Movement?
The objectives of the New Ulster Movement were to preach moderation,
mm-hmm.
and to assist candidates who were in favour of reform.
Then what was some of the debate about whether the New Ulster Movement should become a formal party itself?
Yes, a number of people, such as myself, Bob Cooper and Basil Glass, certainly believed in the autumn of 1969 that there was a need for a new political party, that the New Ulster Movement, while it had been very useful in getting an organisation off the ground of people who were relatively like-minded, wasn't politically going to go anywhere. The people who founded the New Ulster Movement, who called the original meeting, were all former members of the Ulster Liberal Party. And what we had done at the meeting, which formed the New Ulster Movement, was we had put a few people who were clearly not identified as liberals,
mm-hmm.
into the leadership positions,
mm-hmm.
of the New Ulster Movement.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was a man called Brian Walker, who was in as chairman.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a man called Bob Wigan, who was in as vice chairman.
Mm-hmm.
We called a meeting New Ulster movement in a delegate meeting at the end of December in 1969 with a view to basically forming a political party. And there was a considerable resistance to that, mainly by Brian Walker and his friends, who had the same political objectives as we had, but who liked the idea of a nice, comfortable drawing room organisation where mm-hmm. you could write out policies and post them to the minister.
Mm-hmm.
And they put out press statements that say this is what should happen, but weren't interested in hard politics. And that meeting in the end of December 1969 broke up in complete disarray, chaos.
I've seen the minutes of the New Ulster movement, and there was a vote, and the vote was clearly there was a clear majority in favour of establishing, or at least supporting,
mm-hmm.
a new party.
Yes, but there was a split, clear split. What Bob Cooper and myself and Basil Glass then decided to do was to wait for an opportunity which we thought the timing would be more fruitful.
Mm-hmm.
There was a by-election in South Antrim in April of 1970, and the New Ulster movement was asked to consider to supporting a candidate. There was an executive meeting at which they footed around and didn't agree. And
this is the New Ulster movement?
Yes. Just to give their support to a candidate. There was mm-hmm. a fellow standing called Corky, who was standing as an independent, a pro-union independent, but very much an O'Neill type supporter. And in any case, one member of the executive of the New Ulster movement, in fact it was Tony Cinnamond, went out after the meeting, rang the press and said, "We are backing Corky." And it was then a pandemonium, but that's what happened.
Right.
Without me, rang the press and said, "We are backing Corky."
Right.
And I must say I knew what he was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
Corky polled, he didn't win, but he polled about 26%, I think, mm-hmm. of the vote. The seat was won by the Reverend Beattie, who was a henchman at that time of Dr. Paisley. I think they fell out afterwards, but he was at that time. And he won it as a Protestant Unionist or some such thing. But we were relatively surprised, relatively pleased with the degree of support which Corky had got.
What was the controversy supporting Corky within the New Ulster movement?
They didn't want to get... Walker and his cohorts didn't want to dirty their hands with politics. With street politics,
right.
With politics knocking doors and doing that kind of thing.
Okay.
They wanted to have the luxury of putting out well thought out statements on this, that and the other thing. That's basically what it was about. It wasn't about fundamental principles of any kind, it was about strategy.
Right.
And they became more and more dead against getting any real involvement in politics.
Okay.
Quite a large number of activists in the Ulster movement went to South Antrim and knocked doors for Corky and were in fact his election machine. Now, it may not have been a very professional or well organised electoral machine, but it was a very enthusiastic electoral machine.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, for the first time, members of the many members of the New Ulster movement knocked
mm-hmm.
doors for the first time in their lives and said, sometimes with a great deal of shyness. You know, would you think of supporting Mr. Corrie? In any case, that election was on the Thursday before the Alliance Party was launched. When we heard, I was in Bob Cooper's house when we heard the result, and we said, this is good. And also, Paisley had won the band side in a by-election on the same day. And we said, this should frighten the shit out of moderates. The result of that was that we had a meeting in Bangor on the Sunday after the election with the... There was a thing called the Strategy Committee of the new Ulster movement, which Bob Cooper and I were the joint chair. And to a very large extent, the power lay there. Walker and McGuigan as chairman and vice chairman and those treasurers and secretaries, that they thought that the power lay there. But the power lay with our committee.
Right.
And we called our people together and we invited members of the three or four parliamentary associations to send a representative each. And that night we decided to form the Alliance Party and to announce it at a press conference on the following Tuesday. That day and the next day were spent drawing up the original principles of the party and press statements for the launch.
My next question is then, what would have been the original goals of Alliance, specifically in regards to contesting elections? What were its electoral goals as a party?
Sure. There were... intention was to contest elections as soon as it got its organisation together. So the idea was to get stuck in and fight elections more or less wherever they arose once we had an organisation on the ground. The first 18 months of the Alliance Party were close at the stage to nightmare, because we were doing about four or five meetings every week, going to little villages up and down Northern Ireland. There were about four of us, maybe five of us, doing that. To set up, we would call a meeting in a town or a village. We would then we had the records of the New Ulster Movement's membership. So we would notify the people in that area who are associated with the New Ulster Movement and invite them to a public meeting and come and bring your friends, do whatever you want. Then we gave them a spiel about the party, and then we invited them to create a branch of the party in that area.
Did you invite anyone from any of the other parties, say the Liberals or Northern Ireland Labour?
No, we at that stage we only, some members of the Northern Ireland Labour Party may well have been aware members of the New Ulster Movement, and the only Liberal councillors there were only about two or maybe three in Northern Ireland, were also members of the New Ulster Movement, so they would get invited on that, under that heading, and you can bring your friends and bring whoever is interested. What would happen at these meetings is that you would get from time to time a few hostiles and not exactly hecklers, but hostile questioners and that kind of thing, and then the sceptical, and then the convinced. And what normally happened was that the convinced would stay on after the meeting, and they would form the nucleus of a branch in that area, you know. You had Hutt chairman, so secretary, treasurer, etc. So we spent about the best part of 18 months going around setting up that kind of organization. There was we didn't deliberately, as a result of that, we didn't get involved in contesting. I can't remember what elections there may or may not have been in that period, but we decided that we're not going in till we're ready. But quite a number of local councillors joined us. Most of them, not all of them, but most of them would have been, well, or two or three of them were Liberals. I don't think any Northern Ireland Labour Party people joined. They almost tend to be independents.
Mm-hmm.
People who have been an independent councillor in a particular area for some considerable time. And the next crisis basically was when we were more or less got our organisation into shape. Stormont had been suspended, and we were invited, as were other parties, but we were invited to Downing Street by Ted Heath, who was then Prime Minister. And this would have been, I don't know, late 70. I would think late 71. And he basically said, the message we got, I don't know whether he said it or not, but there was two very clear messages. This was just before Stormont was suspended.
Yes.
Before Stormont was suspended. The message was, Faulkner's days are numbered. Stormont will be suspended. And secondly, nobody will be talked to and asked for their opinions unless they actually have elected representatives in Stormont. And we didn't. So, what we did was, Bob Cooper was very great with the late Fiona O'Neill, who was the unionist member for North Down and had been a cabinet minister in previous administration. Hubert Nesbitt, who died a few weeks ago, was the election agent and friend of Bertie McConnell, who was the independent unionist member for Bangor. I think it was called Bangor in those days. And Hubert was a member of the executive of the Alliance Party. And Fiona O'Neill also knew Tommy Gormley, who was an independent nationalist representative for Mid Tyrone or somewhere. So we talked to those people, and we then got to a stage where, and this was in January 72, where everybody was agreed that if the others went, they would go. Yeah, each of the three was agreed that provided the other two went, they would go. And everything was ready for the off. A couple of days later, we went on a Sunday to Derry to see Tommy Gormley. It was a bloody Sunday. Bob Cooper and I went to Derry, and we were aware that there was a lot of tension in the town. We went to Tommy Gormley. We'd all agreed to going the following day. We turned on the television for the news, and there were dead bodies all over the place. So that postponed the declaring for the Alliance Party, but eventually, some weeks later, the three of them did, and for which I'm very grateful. because that then allowed us, as it were, a seat at the talks tables. I don't know why, I never know why, Faulkner didn't think that Stormont was going to be suspended. Because at the meeting we had with Ted Heath, which was some 2 or 3 months before he was suspended, you know, considerably, we came out of that meeting with the absolute conviction that A, Stormont was going to be suspended, and B, that nobody was going to be at the talks table unless they had elected representatives in Stormont. So there was some blockage in Brian's perception. I don't know what it was. Anyway, that gave us an input because we were then consulted in connection with what turned out to be the White Paper and the 1973 Act.
Can you get specific with that? Bob Cooper was telling me about the Darlington Conference.
Yeah, we went to Darlington. All the parties, first of all, the grand plan of Woolley White Law was that the parties who were represented in Stormont would go to Darlington, and that at Darlington we would have a nice exchange of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
For reasons which only they can explain, the SDLP didn't go, and Paisley didn't go.
Mm-hmm.
So what did happen, in fact, was that the Unionist Party, the Alliance Party, and David Blakely for NILP went to Darlington. If you had representatives in Stormont, you could have your own delegation. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. the Stormont elected representative was your key into the talks, but you could send your own people. The Unionists went, and I think that was a kind of Rubicon in Brian Faulkner's thinking. Hard to explain this, but I think that Faulkner thought there was going to be some easy solution back to the status quo until he met us in Darlington, and certainly the Alliance Party in Darlington made very clear that there was going to be, that they weren't agreeing, and also the British government representatives, when the unions were talking about, if we can only do such and such and such, and then get back to, wait a minute, that's not the scenario. Surprisingly, Blakely was arguing, I think even more strongly, for the unionist position than the unionists were, but that's a by the by. The unionists came away from Darlington, Faulkner in particular, mm-hmm. came away from Darlington with the clear understanding that it wasn't anything like as simple as he had thought. That there were going to have to be concessions of a kind that the Unionist Party had never thought of before.
What was that? I mean, what kinds of concessions?
Well, I think that he without getting into detail, I think he saw that the traditional opposition was going to have to be involved in the future administration. You can parse it by saying power sharing,
mm-hmm.
but and we weren't talking about detail, but I think that Faulkner and some of his colleagues got the message that the British government were not talking about a few little minor
token.
Fix that there and fix that there. They were talking about something which was they were talking in far more radical terms than Faulkner had thought when he arrived.
Right.
And that was clear. That was clear throughout the Darlington talks, that the unionists, particularly Faulkner, would say, well, what they could really do is do such and such. That was yesterday's game.
Was it?
So, certainly the more intelligent unionists, of which Faulkner was an intelligent gentleman, more intelligent unionists left Darlington, knowing that minor concessions were not going to be enough, and I think knowing that power sharing and some type of Irish dimension were not just on the table by the British government, but were key elements of any agreement or any new institutions. In fact, it was one of the very few conferences that I have been at, and I was at quite a lot of them, where suddenly you could actually see the penny beginning to drop from the beginning of the conference to the end of the conference. That what had started off on that plane very rapidly moved to another one.
Can you describe your involvement in the Alliance Party's submission or written proposal for government at the Darlington Conference?
Yeah.
I understand that this was published, but I'd like to know specifically what your...
I have a copy of
it. You have a copy here?
Yeah.
Oh, excellent.
I'll get you a photocopy.
That
you got that. These are the proposals that we put to the government.
Is that... I'm going to put this on pause for a second.
...were drafted...
They're drafted mainly by yourself and Bob.
Bob and I basically put them together, and then we got them agreed at the executive, the party. But Bob and I drew them up.
What was the rationale or the thinking behind them?
We were committed very much to a power sharing structure. Actually, the Irish dimension, as far as we were concerned, was of much less importance than a power sharing, a fair, decent administration in Northern Ireland. But one of the things that Bob and I recognised was that if you were going to have an inclusive administration, that you could not have cabinet responsibility. In other words, you could not expect all the ministers to have a common agenda, and that it was therefore that you could either do it one of two ways. You could say, let us have an agreed voluntary coalition, which we rejected. Or let us have the thing as inclusive as possible. And that meant that political parties, in accordance with their elected strengths, would in fact be entitled to be ministers.
Can you go back to voluntary coalition? What is that?
Well, that we looked at the question as to whether or not a number of parties could get together and agree
a common candidate list or something.
A common list, and that in fact is what happened in the Stormont Castle talks in 1973. That the parties that wanted to be involved went down to Stormont Castle buildings, and we had meeting after meeting after meeting, and that ended up with the production of a an agreed policy statement,
mm-hmm.
B, agreed ministerial posts.
So when was this? I'm ignorant of this.
This is the first power-sharing executive,
mm-hmm.
1973.
Yes.
And in fact, what did happen in 1973 was that three parties who wished to explore forming a power-sharing administration,
mm-hmm.
spent a number of weeks on the chairmanship of Willie Whitelaw at Stormont Castle, in which we finally reached an agreement whereby we had a common agenda and various ministerial posts were handed out.
But you said the party was opposed to this?
Sorry. That was not what we had proposed.
Right.
That's not the approach we had proposed.
Mm.
The approach we had proposed was much closer to what was agreed at Good Friday.
Right.
Very, very close to what was agreed at Good Friday than what actually happened
under
Sunnydale.
What were your specific objections to that type of arrangement?
Because it excluded people who were democratically elected. In other words, it was impossible to have a common agenda with all parties who would have reasonable representation in an administration. Now, at that time, Sinn Féin was not a factor.
Mm.
The DUP was a factor.
Mm.
And once you have an inside body which has reached agreement between themselves, then you exclude those who are not
mm-hmm.
in the cosy little club. And by excluding them, that you not only exclude them from, as we saw it, from the administration, but you actually excluded them really from the new institutions which you were setting up. And we thought that was unfortunate. And therefore, what we were basically saying to the British government, and which included in our submissions to the White Paper, is, look, you appoint the ministers approximately in accordance with their electoral strengths.
Mm-hmm.
Like to hunt, but I don't think I was aware of the hunt principles at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember, but I don't actually think it was.
Mm.
And the word "the hunt" certainly wasn't used in our proposals. But it was the same principle, that by PR you mm-hmm. proportionally chose people who would then be the minister, in effect.
Mm-hmm.
They would meet together from time to time to discuss strategy, but there was no there was to be no concept of ministerial unity.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have to have cabinet responsibility. They could be a minister in their own right, having been elected, with a committee of their department, mm-hmm. a departmental committee, also elected by proportional mm-hmm. representation from various parties, and they would run their department with the assistance or help of mm-hmm. the committee, and subject to ruling of the House.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if that had happened, I think it more likely than not, and I'll not put it any higher than that, that Paisley and the anti-Faulkner unionists would have taken their ministries and would have been within the system rather than without. In other words,
okay.
they
Well, I call it loyal opposition. Well, no, it's not a loyal opposition. Sorry.
Sure. Once you we're creating new, completely new structures for government, totally new structures. Those who, at the end of the day, became excluded, mm-hmm. mainly suggesting it wasn't to a considerable extent because that's what they chose to be, but nevertheless, if the system of administration had been such that it included them without them having to agree anything with Faulkner or the SDLP or Alliance Party, the failure of that experiment might not have happened. Put it before that, might not have happened.
Do you think?
And that's why in our thinking at that time, and certainly my thinking ever since, and was that you have to have a system which does not exclude people with who have an electoral strength, but doesn't and doesn't say you can only come in if you agree to A, B, C, and D.
Do you believe? I appreciate what you're saying about you don't believe that. It's possible to have a common agenda.
Across the board.
Across the board. But likewise, do you believe that stable government is possible if different parties are taking their ministries in opposite directions to other ministries?
Provide all the ministries would be subject to the democratic decision of the House. And therefore, I do not believe people pulling in opposite directions. There would have been, what happens in any cabinet situation, and that is individual ministers fighting very hard for a bigger slice of the financial cake for mm-hmm. their department. You get that on the floor of the House, not in the cabinet.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, under our proposals, when the various ministers met together, they would agree as to how resources would be allocated.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing. Yeah. It includes the other Thanks. People also.
Thanks. Now, do you believe that it mattered whether Alliance stood elections, won seats, and earned a ministry under such an arrangement?
It mattered to Alliance, and it mattered to whether or not an administration was going to be set up in 1973, whether a power-sharing segment was going to be set up. Without the Alliance Party's 8 votes, the Faulkner Unionists and the SDLP between them would not have had a working majority. So it was our 8 votes that gave the working majority. And
but what if people stopped voting Alliance and or if for whatever reason neither Unionist nor Nationalist had by themselves a 51% majority, did it matter if the ministry was based on
As far as we were concerned, under our proposals, which were that you got ministerial positions in accordance with your electoral strength, it didn't matter what particular parties got except to themselves and to their electorates, mm-hmm. because as with the Good Friday Agreement situation, you know, you would have had SDLP entitled to 3 ministries, official unions entitled mm-hmm. to 4, whatever it was, mm-hmm. based upon their electoral strength. What happened under the 73 Act was that our proposals were not accepted by the government in the legislation. And the legislation said there shall be a power-sharing executive, which could only then be done by agreement between some of the parties.
Mm-hmm.
And the Official Unionist Party and the SDLP in that situation between them did not have a working majority.
Mm-hmm.
And the Alliance Party was essential to that. And we did have 2 ministries. Adam Ministry and Bob Cooper Ministry.
Right. What did you? What conditions did you believe were necessary in order for a power-sharing form of government to work, whether the model adopted by the government or your proposed model?
Well, our proposed model was not adopted by the government, and therefore it, in effect, didn't come into it.
Mm-hmm.
I still believe that our proposal in a divided society, the kind we have, made more sense than the government's proposal. And certainly in the Good Friday Agreement, I think that the present government is convinced of that argument, namely that a coalition between a number of parties, by its definition, will exclude others. And that exclusion is not desirable if you're trying to create new institutions. As far as the government's proposal is concerned, a working majority was created in 1973. The party was the 1st of January 74, 2nd of January 74. Working majority was achieved. What would have happened in the next election? You were completely at the mercy of an electorate as to whether or not three or four compatible parties representing both sections of a divided community could or could not reach an agreement and have a working majority.
Mm-hmm.
It was there was no feel-safe situation. We could have gone into an election, if the thing had lasted, we could have gone into an election in 74, whatever, 77, whatever it was. And that could have ended up with the SDLP, the pro-Faulkner-type unionists, and the Alliance Party having between them less than a working majority. And the anti-power-sharing unionists saying, we're not going to share power with the SDLP, or for that matter, with the Alliance Party. now, that the system created under the 73 Act then just failed to take any account of the wishes of the electorate, and there wouldn't have been an administration.
What do you think? What are your thoughts about the actual failure of the Sonningdale government?
Well, personally, I was extremely disappointed. I thought it was the best, with all its problems, and I've mentioned one of them. I thought it was the best opportunity that Northern Ireland had since partition to create a stable and workable administration. I still think it was the best deal that the unionists would ever get. I think from their point of view that it was a damn good deal.
Mm-hmm.
Many of the major opponents to power sharing at that time were David Trimble of Vanguard, Reginald MP Sir Reg of Vanguard, John Taylor of the Official Unionist Party, and I could name quite a number of others. Whose objection was clearly stated to be they were opposed to power sharing with nationalists. The 25 years has changed the whole climate. What Brian Faulkner learnt at Darlington, it took them 25 more years to learn. That is, there wasn't going to be an administration in Northern Ireland, a local administration in Northern Ireland, without involvement of major sections, so major groups of both sections of the population, without power sharing.
Mm-hmm.
And now, surprising enough, power sharing with the SDLP is not an issue with anybody. It is power sharing with Sinn Féin, with the guns still unadded over, is an issue with quite a lot of unionists. but the other isn't. But I think that, 25 years, which had not been very good for Northern Ireland, might well have been avoided if that administration had lasted. And I think that if our proposals at Darlington, and the White Paper, mm-hmm. had been thought about a little more, it might have lasted.
Mm-hmm.
Because I suspect that the anti-power-sharing people would, under our system, have taken their ministries.
Just want to...
The other thing I mm-hmm. say about
Sunningdale?
About Sunningdale and the power sharing. In Sunningdale, the Council of Ireland that was set up
mm-hmm.
Was more a fig leaf for nationalists than something with any great power. I'll give you two reasons. One, the Council of Ireland had to operate on a unanimous basis. Any single minister, by saying no to a proposal, meant that that proposal wasn't going to carry. And unanimity was the name of the game with the Council of Ireland. And secondly, when it came to the allocation of powers to the Council of Ireland, it was actually in the Northern Ireland executive very funny, because SDLP nationalist ministers who had been fighting so hard for the Council of Ireland when it came to handing over any bits of their ministry to it. another ball game. I remember the late Paddy Devlin, indicating in no uncertain terms and using a few four-letter words about that nobody was going to take any bit, no Council of Ireland and anyone going to take any bits of his ministry. So that what the Council of Ireland was going to be left with under the Sunningdale type situation was a few relatively uncontroversial matters, like probably tourist promotion to some extent, eradication of animal diseases, joint waterways, the Foyle estuary and stuff mm-hmm. like that. That's what we're going to end up with. Because the southern ministers had no more desire to hand over bits of their ministry to the Council of Ireland mm-hmm. than the SDLP or the Fishers Unions or Alliance did.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody, when it came to the bit, what part are you giving of your mm-hmm. of your administration to the Council mm-hmm. of Ireland? The answer was, most people, was, do I have to give any?
Mm-hmm. But I recall reading some articles penned by yourself in the mid-70s in regards to north-south links.
Mm-hmm.
And I recall your comments being it was a bit premature.
Sorry. Let me put it this way to you.
Mm-hmm.
The Alliance Party, in relation to what was then known as the Irish Dimension,
mm-hmm.
was, to put it at its highest, somewhat lukewarm, because we thought the basic priority was to get an administration, partial administration, operating in Northern Ireland, and that the Council of Ireland, Sunningdale type arrangements, could in fact wreck the administration being set up in Northern Ireland. And to a very large extent, I think that was what did happen. I mean, the slogan in that 74 Westminster election was, Dublin is but a Sunningdale away. And the whole emphasis was on the Council of Ireland being the first step to United Ireland. I accept that a lot more unionists then were opposed to power sharing with the SDLP. I think if the Council of Ireland had not been there to plague us,
mm.
that there would not have been the opposition that there was.
I understand you, particularly in regards to the actual type of power sharing government that was established.
Absolutely. And I'm not the the Alliance Party is not the only party that felt that. I can assure you that Jerry Fitt, who was then chair, leader of the SDLP, felt exactly the same. Paddy Devlin felt exactly the same. Conor Cruise O'Brien felt exactly the same. And during the discussions in Sunningdale, myself, I think Bob was with me, Paddy Devlin and Conor Cruise O'Brien asked for a meeting with Liam Cosgrove and said, look, you're pushing this far too bloody far. Your Brian Faulkner is going to be left naked. You're pushing this thing far too far. And we have a power sharing executive. Now, the person who went through us was Garrett. Garrett the Good. Mm-hmm. Garrett went ballistic. Faulkner was the most competent politician that Northern Ireland ever had, blah, 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 that he'd been in politics all his life. You know, he must know what he was doing, and that the Council of Ireland and all of this was, power sharing was totally dependent upon whether we could get a suitable agreement on Council of Ireland, etc., etc., and if we couldn't get suitable agreement, then there was going to be no power share. Because the SDLP won't pull out.
Did you believe that?
Nope. Didn't believe it. But that's what he said. And Liam Cosgrove backed down. Liam was at that time, he was Taoiseach.
Right.
And Garrett was Foreign Affairs, I think.
Yeah.
I think he was Foreign Affairs. But anyway, the strong man was Garrett, of course. He was wound up by John Hume, but because Hume had ideological reasons for it. Fitt was very unhappy. Devlin was very unhappy. And that basically when the fractures in SDLP began.
I was going to say
left, which meant that Jerry and it was some years later.
Do you know how John Hume felt about that?
John Hume was arguing very, very strongly for a Council of Ireland with the maximum amount of powers. One stage he wanted all policing to be handled by the Council of Ireland. The only reason that didn't happen was because the Minister of Justice and Public said, not my police force. You can have the RUC, but you're not having my police force. The Council of Ireland agenda was largely John Hume, drawn by John Hume, and sold by him to elements in the southern government. I think largely, mainly Garrett Fitzgerald, because there was, I think Liam Cosgrove was on our side.
Mm-hmm.
I think Liam was on our side. But he was a far less articulate and tough operator than Garrett Fitzgerald. I mean, he just wasn't in the same league. Garrett just...
Yeah. That's, I just want to talk, and whatever you want to say, just intervening years
right.
between the fall of Stormont and, most recent talks process.
Right.
Is there anything you would like to say in regards to hunger strikes, the Anglo-Irish Agreement, Brooke Mayhew talks in regards to Alliance's involvement and realizing Alliance's perspective, Alliance's policies on power sharing?
Well, first of all, in the intervening years, the late 70s were good for Alliance. I mean, we did rather well in the late 70s. I came within a few hundred votes of winning East Belfast. I think that was 79.
Mm-hmm.
We, in our local government elections in 1977, we did very well. We got 13 or 14%.
Mm-hmm.
About 70-odd councillors. The hunger strike was undoubtedly a major problem for us. Let me make it quite clear that I was not sympathetic to the demands of the prisoners. I think Thatcher's stridency was unfortunate. I think she turned a lot of people off, but on fundamental principles, I was not. As leader of the Alliance Party at that time, the Alliance Party was not sympathetic to what was happening in the jails. But the effect of the hunger strike, first of all, totally radicalized large sections of the urban nationalist community. I can't talk so much for rural areas because there was always in large parts of Mid-Ulster, Fermanagh South, Tyrone, a vote which was sympathetic to Sinn Féin. And a vote also which voted for any Catholic nationalist that was standing against any unionist. And it didn't matter whether they were in jail or in hunger strike or what the hell they were. They're one of us and not one of them. But it had a substantially difficult effect for us in Catholic urban areas, particularly working class urban areas. And secondly, it radicalized a lot of Protestant unionist opinion. We saw people who were prepared to starve themselves to death for a cause as being terribly frightening, and it therefore brought a lot of people back into their own camp. I certainly remember having talks with people in East Belfast at that time. We just found it incredible that people would, one after the other, be prepared to starve themselves to death for a cause. And very frightening. Very frightening. We partly recovered from that. It was very hard work, but we partly recovered from that in the end of 81 and into 82. And then there were the assembly elections in 1982. And while we didn't do brilliantly, we had a very careful we organized it very carefully. We knew exactly what we were doing. And in fact, the week before, I predicted to the Irish Independent, they said, what seats will the Lions get? And I said, they will get 10, and do you wish me to tell you what 10 they are? They published that. We recovered partially, but it went further than that. Then that assembly was a mess. Simply because the SDLP weren't in, and Sinn Féin obviously weren't in. I think SDLP at that stage, to be blunt, I think they were frightened to go in because of Sinn Féin. Frightened. And but with their boycott, it wasn't going anywhere. Once that fell, and again, I think this brought home very much to the unionist population in, let's say, 1985, 86. Now, there wasn't going to be a short cut back to Stormont. And I think that people like John Taylor, and Reg Embey, and David Trimble, etc., that their learning process started with the failure of the prior assembly. They saw that what looked to them as possibly an easy route through wasn't going to be.
What about the effect of the Anglo-Irish Agreement on opinion?
The Anglo-Irish Agreement had very little effect, in my view, on the nationalist community. but an enormous effect on very large sections of the unionist community. They were infuriated. Very largely, they were infuriated because it had come to them out of the blue and they hadn't had any consultation whatsoever. I must say, I'm not on the same side as very many members, of the Alliance Party on this issue.
Well, I want to ask you what your opinion is.
I thought that what the British government should have done at that time was to consult with the unionists, even if it was only telling them what they were going to do and that they were going to do it anyway, you know. But what was happening was the Dublin government were consulting week in, week out with the SDLP, and nobody, the British government was consulting with nobody. So you had a situation where the SDLP and the nationalist and Republican communities knew what was happening, knew what was going to happen, and the unionists were completely in the dark, and part of their huge anger was that they were taken by a complete surprise. The government's answer to it was there was no point in consulting them because they wouldn't have gone along anyway. Mm-hmm. But I don't buy that. And surprising enough, Mary Robinson resigned also from the, she resigned from the Irish Labour Party over that very issue. That that it was not right that one community should have been part of the negotiations, actually, part of the negotiations leading up to it, and the other community was completely in the dark. Also, of course, it was a factor with the unionists was they believed that Maggie Thatcher was a lady not for turning. Maggie Thatcher was the greatest turncoat prime minister that the British have had since the war, and why the reputation should have got to her that she didn't change her mind. Who signed the European Single Act? It was Maggie Thatcher. Mm-hmm. She was screaming against Europe before she did it. Mm-hmm. She was screaming against Europe after she did it, and she signs the Single Act, which is the greatest single step towards European unity that there is. And she had said some weeks before the Hillsborough Declaration, that's out. And the unions believed her. What they didn't know was that that leaving out local economics, she didn't have any principles. She did have about market economics in the UK, but once you got outside that, she didn't have. She didn't have any guidelines up there even, not only principles, she didn't have any guidelines. Mm-hmm. So she could be switched on Single European Act,
But what about the Alliance Party's views? I've been told that there was a debate about whether to support her or not, and yet I'm trying to find evidence of what the debate
was. I will tell you what it was. We were summoned to a meeting in Stormont by the then leader John Cushnan,
the party executive,
and the elected rep, the elected it was the party executive and I think the people who had been members of the assembly.
When?
And I think it was called Strategy Committee. It was the day that the announcement was made. And it was an emergency meeting. And I was at the meeting. And there was a debate. And John Cushnahan, as leader, said, we must give this a try. It has to be. We must, while we're not necessarily going to overwhelmingly support it, we are not going to criticise it, condemned, but who say must be given a chance. It then transpired that John had already spoken to the press and already given them this view, which meant that the debate was not...
Did members of the executive already know this?
Well, some of them certainly did. I argued at that meeting against, I said, we shouldn't support it. And the reasons that I gave for not supporting it were, first of all, our Protestant supporters in the main would consider it a betrayal. And we had said we would never betray the basic principles which were held by either section of the community. And secondly, that they should have been consulted. The union should have been consulted, not consulted. I did get a seconder, but I didn't get very much other support.
I understand.
The support was overwhelmingly...
Gordon Mawhinney was also opposed.
There were, Gordon... My memory of the situation is that there was about four of us or so who were opposed, and the rest of them went along with the line that we must give this...
Was there a formal vote?
There was, yes. It was a formal vote.
Okay.
Whether it was recorded or not, I don't know.
I'll find out.
Whether it's just a show of hands, I don't know. I was against, when he was against, there was a councillor from Lisbon called Jones who was against. Seamus Close was nearly against. I think he abstained or something. He was...
not comfortable.
He was not very happy with it. But the problem was that John had already committed himself and as the leader of the party, he committed the party. Then we had elections when the unionist MPs resigned. And I again took the view that we should not get involved in those elections. That if they were going to give up their seats, that let them go back and let them have no opposition except their own invented opposition. They put up candidates, Peter Barry lookalikes or something. And my view was that they were creating this situation. It was not any way of our making. They were resigning their seats and let them have the pleasure or embarrassment of having no opposition to fight them except invented opposition. That was not accepted.
Did that come to a vote? I mean, when was this decision made? Was this made at an executive or was it made at strategy? Paul Org?
I can't remember.
Right. A decision was made
and then
to stand.
I went to the East Belfast Association meeting, met. Well, I wasn't on the executive, therefore couldn't have been made an executive. The East Belfast Association met and we decided on a vote by a slight majority not to fight. And the powers that be were not happy with that decision. And I was told that as former leader of the party, it looked as if there would be a split in the party, etc., etc., if I did not fight East Belfast. And that democratic decision had been taken to fight the elections, and therefore that it was up to me to go back to my association and get the vote reversed.
I'm a little confused. Did the East Belfast Local Association
voted not to fight,
but the party central had decided to fight in all constituencies?
Right. Well, they had decided to fight it as if it was an any ordinary
any
general
election.
And the two, I remember now, the two meetings took place the same evening. And we had taken our vote, which was not the fight, and John Alderdice, who was on the executive, arrived late at the meeting and said the executive had decided to fight them. Let them fight. We're not fighting. And then I had a couple of weeks of tense pressure, quite intense, in which it was alleged that if we didn't fight, that we were in fact letting down John Cushton as leader of the party.
Mm-hmm.
So with great reluctance, I agreed to fight.
Right.
I told them that we would get time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, truly throunced, but I agreed to fight.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the only reason I agreed to fight, and that was because it was good to me that it would look as if it was stabbing the leader in the back. I don't think it would have, but that's yesterday's argument.
Sure.
But
well,
quite a number of others didn't fight.
Mm-hmm.
Seamus Close didn't fight. Lisburn mm-hmm. decided that they weren't getting involved in that argument. And there were quite a number of places that decided not to fight.
Right.
But, I say, the person, because I was the immediately past leader, the pressure was put on me.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I can really say about the intervening years. In 1989...
I'd like to get to governing with consent and the party's sort of new proposals. I understand Paul McGuire was the main architect.
Paul McGuire was the main architect. I was not involved to any mm-hmm. real extent in governing with consent.
What's your opinion of it as a policy paper when it appeared? Things you like, don't like about it?
Can I say this to you? And this may sound slightly cynical. I said to myself, there's not going to be the opportunity of putting together any administration in Northern Ireland for quite a number of years. And this is nice enough to put around as a piece of policy paper, but it's not going anywhere. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That unless you have a prospect of putting something, having an input and putting something into effect.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in the Ulster Liberal Party, we used to write lovely policy papers about the way that Northern Ireland industry could be rejuvenated. They were bits of paper. Nothing was ever going to happen mm-hmm. to them.
Mm-hmm.
They were, in my view, largely a waste of time.
Mm-hmm.
But governing with consent, I must say, at the time, I didn't really study in tremendous detail. I read through it. Okay.
What did you think was the best venue for affecting change?
A local administration.
No, but to get the kind of government that you wanted,
through papers. It was going to be through discussions and negotiations. I mean, we spent nearly 2 years in the Good Friday discussions of strong buildings. We were going down every week to the Forum for Peace and Reconciliation in Dublin.
Before that, there were the Brooke Mayhew talks, though.
Yeah, I wasn't involved in Mayhew talks.
And what did you think about the efforts that the Alliance was making in the talks?
I thought that they were doing a good job. I think they did a good job.
Why do you think that they...
I thought they were being realistic. I thought that they...
To finish my question, why do you think that the Brugmeier talks didn't succeed, in your opinion?
Two words, John Hume.
You're not the first person to say that. And why do you think that John
Hume... I am absolutely convinced that the talks failed, not because of SDLP, because there were members of the SDLP who had reached tentative agreements. And when Hume heard about it, Hume just squashed it.
Eddie Morrow gave me a detailed account.
Well, I wasn't involved. When I say I wasn't involved, I was up on a number of occasions chatting to the negotiating team and that kind of thing. But the problem was John Hume.
And then the significance of the Hume Adams talks.
Well, I think that the Hume Adams talks obviously have been extremely significant. I have absolutely no doubt that it was John Hume very largely who convinced Adams to convince the IRA to have a ceasefire. And therefore, in that way, I give John Hume a lot of credit for that. You know, he took political risks. One of the problems is, I think, that the political process was then made too easy for Sinn Féin.
Well, one question I have for you is, how do you think that bringing Republicans politically into negotiations would affect the likelihood of any government, even the one envisioned by yourself in 1972? Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you think that bringing Republicans in was... You wanted an inclusive government in which ministries could be determined by the strengths of the parties. Do you believe that that is possible with Republicans?
Yes, I do believe it is possible with Republicans, but I do think, and lawyers, I do think that the problem is what is meant by a ceasefire, what is meant by a cessation of violence, what they mean by democratic process. I actually do take the view that the decommissioning, or you know, the handing over of arms, was an issue which the Unionist Party should not have given.
Why do you feel it's not
relevant?
Not important?
Because I don't think it's particularly relevant. One, there was going to be considerable resistance by the IRA to doing it. Two, in Irish physical force politics, it had never happened before. Three, if you give up your arms, you can rearm tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I mean, the handing over or the destruction of arms isn't the big thing. It's the non-using of them. Mm-hmm. And I'm far more critical of the Republican movement's murdering of Charles Bennett and killing anybody who the notion takes them.
Mm-hmm.
On the grounds that they were drug dealers or anti-social types or police informers or whatever. That would be where I would concentrate. If the guns are totally silent, I don't care where they are. What worries me much more is that the guns are only partially silent. I'm not saying the ceasefire that we do have is not a lot better than no ceasefire at all.
Mm-hmm.
But you do have to have some kind of democratic guidelines against which Sinn Féin and the IRA are judged. And I don't, by the way, for one moment that they're not more or less one organization.
Well, let's talk about those guidelines. During the multi-party talks, the Alliance Party made petitions to the Secretary of State against a number of parties. The Ulster Unionists, the DUP, Sinn Féin, and the UDP. Did you support
Yes.
Those indictments.
Yes. In fact, one of those indictments was brought when in Dublin Castle during inter-party talks in Dublin Castle, when in fact I was at the top table supporting that exclusion. And it wasn't that I wanted them out of the talks. Let's get that quite clear. What I wanted was that the guidelines as to when is a ceasefire should be clearly laid down.
Mm-hmm.
And what had happened with Sinn Féin at that time was they'd gone around murdering a few people.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as far as I can gather, their thinking is a ceasefire is a ceasefire if we're not shooting the other side. But we reserve to ourselves the exclusive right to shoot our own. Now, that to me isn't a ceasefire. I therefore supported the Alliance Party's exclusion applications mm-hmm. in relation to a number of parties, in the hope that we would get, in those talks, a clear definition of what is non-violent democratic politics. We didn't.
Do you believe government is possible if, for whichever right reasons, any party gets excluded because of a breach of ceasefire? Do you think that it would not destabilize the whole government?
No, certainly it would. Certainly would destabilize it. And that's why I was rather anxious to get the guidelines laid down before, not after, but before. And that's why, for example, we applied to, for example, to exclude Sinn Féin and to exclude some loyalist parties, etc. It was on the question of support for violence or failure to oppose violence. Now, the Good Friday Agreement fudged that issue, and it got on to an issue of decommissioning, and I come back to say it's not the handing over of arms that worry me, it is the use of
mm-hmm.
use of anything in form of violence. And Mo Molan was put in an enviable position this week. If she said that the ceasefire had been breached, then that meant the exclusion of Sinn Féin from the peace process, and that may well have escalated into violence of not just shooting their own lot, but shooting the other side's lot as well. And on the other hand, to cynically have to say, I don't think there has been a breach of ceasefire. Well, I don't buy that. I don't buy that.
Let's talk about the agreement itself. We are coming towards the end.
Right, that's right.
I remember your comment when the agreement was announced that
I thought it was a bloody miracle.
You were very joyous and said
yes,
that you worked so hard.
I thought it was a bloody miracle. Still think it was a miracle.
Mm-hmm.
Still think it was a miracle. Because while I am pessimistic about the chances of George Mitchell being able to produce what is in effect an agreement between the official unionists and Sinn Féin, I'm very pessimistic about that. I do not think that it is likely that such an impasse is going to be sorted out. I hope I'm wrong, but I am pessimistic. But the Good Friday Agreement has pushed the political situation on enormously, whether an executive is formed or not. It is an agreement on some very fundamental matters with the official Unionist Party and Sinn Féin. Sinn Féin have bought into a partitionist solution. in the hope that someday that will change. But they have bought into the de facto situation that Northern Ireland is part of the United Kingdom, and try to work on that.
Mm-hmm.
During the inter-party talks, I remember members of Sinn Féin saying, we will never go into an assembly, whether we stand for election or not. We haven't decided yet, but we're never going into a British partitionist assembly in Northern Ireland. And they meant it at that time. So, on the other hand, the unionists have accepted cross-border bodies with executive powers. They have accepted power sharing with Sinn Féin under certain circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, the Good Friday Agreement in itself is a dramatic document,
mm-hmm.
and has changed the face of politics in Northern Ireland completely forever, whether an executive has ever said it or not. That's
mm-hmm.
my view.
Mm-hmm. Specifically in regards to Strand 1, in regards to the devolved administration, the designation of elected representatives and the voting procedures, which require and the numbered mm-hmm. requirements. What is your opinion about that? Are those satisfactory to you, or would you like to see them otherwise?
I can express it in a couple of sentences. I think it was inevitable to get an assembly off the ground, and I hope that in the years to come that it will be no longer necessary. But I think it was essential to get it off the ground. Instinctively it offends me, but I accept that it had to be.
I'm arguing that it provides a disincentive for voters to vote for any party that's not a unionist or nationalist party.
I agree with that. It does provide a disincentive.
And a logical outcome is that support for all capital O other parties
mm-hmm.
would decline. Do you believe that matters?
Yes, I think it matters. The voting system that was devised did create, in effect, a sectarian carve-up. There wouldn't have been an agreement without it. You can take my word for that. The SDLP mm-hmm. would not have bought in without it,
mm-hmm.
neither would Sinn Féin.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore I have reluctantly, and against my better instincts, got to say that it was necessary, because there wouldn't have been an executive without it. There wouldn't have been an assembly without it. There wouldn't have been an agreement without it.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I do have to say that it is a disincentive to people to vote for outside the tribal camps. And secondly, I would hope that it would be a temporary phenomenon, not a permanent one.
What would be your proposals or suggestions about how that can be overcome, whether it's through alliance or through dialogue?
The only way that you can get to a situation where that might be that barrier may be
mm-hmm.
broken
mm-hmm.
is if you have an assembly which is working very well for several years and where parties trust each other. That's the only circumstance.
Is there any requirement for trust in the type of arrangement that's...
No, there is no requirement for trust, because the type of administration which is proposed
mm-hmm.
does not require agreement or trust. But inevitably, when people are working together, particularly in committees and that kind of thing, it grows up. It happens. Let me just give you an
mm-hmm.
example.
Mm-hmm.
During the inter-party talks, Sinn Féin marched into the talks, and the official unionists, DUP, Bob McCartney, and the two loyalist parties went out. Eventually, after 2 days or so, the official unionists and the two loyalist parties returned. They indicated in no uncertain terms that they were never going to speak to to Sinn Féin. They were going to simply do everything through the chair. They weren't going to reply to any questions or anything that Sinn Féin raised, that they were just treating them as if they weren't there. Within a very few months, within a very few months, it was Morning Jerry, Low David, Low Martin, Low Reg, and there were being private meetings between the official unionist leadership and Sinn Féin leadership, etc. Because contact with human beings mainly, usually creates that type of situation. And in politics, you are trying to get things operational, and it means saying to your political opponents, look, we're meeting about this, a few things you want to do. And at those wee meetings, it soon becomes not Mr. Smith, but Johnny and Paddy, etc., etc. And then after that, you go and have a cup of coffee together. Discuss last night's football match.
Who does who do people who do not describe themselves as exclusively unionist or nationalist, or describe themselves as neither, support and under the current arrangement?
Sorry, the people who under the Alliance Party has said we are neither unionist nor nationalist. We are all.
Do you support that?
Huh?
Do you support that?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. I think it would be absolutely fatal for the Alliance Party to take any other position. On principle, I know there was a very big argument being put forward.
Well, there's the women's there's a women's coalition who, you know, also so they take a different view.
The women's coalition are also other. They have said, which we haven't, that if Trimble was in trouble, they would join, become unionists. We had that argument, and it was rejected. But there are people in the party who take the view that the agreement is more important than the immediate implementation of the agreement is more important than anything else. It's a view which I don't agree with, but which I can understand the passion with which it is held. There are people who are not represented in the Assembly who would also be others. There are people like the Democratic Left, and very small groups. But it's basically the Alliance Party and the Women's Coalition. I have always taken the view that the centre in Northern Ireland was too small to divide. I still take that view.
If the SDLP and the Ulster Unionist are seen as the moderate wings trying to work together vis-a-vis their paramilitary extremes, then What is the rationale for somebody who perhaps is inclined to consider voting Alliance to vote Alliance and not for one of those two parties?
Well, there are certainly a considerable number of people in the unionist community who would be inclined to vote for Alliance. We take the view at this moment in time that David Trimble is doing his best and that David Trimble deserves their support. And that was very, very clearly shown in the last European elections, where, I'll tell you this, that a number of very serious, very senior people in the Alliance Party, including former deputy leaders, to my knowledge, because they told me, voted for Nicholson. And they did so, and these paid-up members of the party, and they did so on this argument, that it was essential for the peace process to continue that Nicholson beat Sinn Féin. Otherwise, his credibility was down the lane, and that it didn't serve their purpose to vote Sean number one and Nicholson number two, because the credibility of Nicholson was going to be on what first preference votes he got. I think he got 1,500 more than Sinn Féin, but if he had got less than Sinn Féin, certainly Trimble was in trouble. That is tactical voting. I didn't do it.
But I'm saying, if with that, I'm just trying to understand that logic. With that logic, then why not adopt the position in the assembly of designating oneself as unionist or unionist and nationalist or unionist or nationalist, if it's more important to shore up support?
My view simply is that it's more important, that they consider it more important to shore up support in the immediate time scale now.
I.e. the election.
Yeah. I am looking on a longer time scale.
Right.
And I do not wish to see, I mean, say we get an executive, say we get everything operational here. If I'm around in 20 years, I don't want to see a Northern Ireland which has been carved up in a neat, careful, sectarian carve-up, in which nationalists and Republicans have that say, and unionists have that say, and there's nobody else.
Why do you think either the unionists or the nationalists would let go of their privileges, their voting privileges?
I don't think they will let go unless they consider that it is no longer of use, of any importance to them. And that means a much greater atmosphere of trust than we have now or have ever had in the past.
Well, last question I have for you is then, what do you think the role of the Alliance Party is for the now and the future?
I think the role of the Alliance Party is to basically say and convince the public that that a sectarian carve-up is not the right way forward. That what we have to have as a party is a non-sectarian liberal democracy. Surprisingly, I think that if we get an administration operating, it'll be much easier to sell that.
But academically, one could argue that the agreement is far from a liberal democracy. It's what's called a consociational democracy.
Sorry, I would say the agreement is very far from it. I think what we have got to do as a party is try to convince the electorate that we are the party of liberal democracy and that we should have support on that basis. I think at the present time that would be nearly impossible to do in any large scale, because people are looking for the implementation of the agreement. That's the only thing. For or against is the only thing they're interested in.
Well, I'm gonna ask you a hard question.
Right.
Is in a liberal democracy, there's a government in opposition, and you need a loyal opposition.
Yeah.
But at the beginning of this interview, you described that you didn't believe that you could have a government in a divided society like Northern Ireland's, which purposely excluded. And you gave a very good explanation about how it's very arbitrary on elections. How do you get from a consociational democracy envisioned in the agreement to a liberal democracy that you want?
Because I don't accept your first principles on this. I do not think that it is absolutely essential for liberal democracy to have a government and a loyal opposition. I don't think that. I think there are very many other ways of creating a liberal democracy, and that the way we set out in the white paper proposals is, particularly in divided society, as good a way as any, better than most. In a way, you could say that Northern Ireland has in the past had a loyal opposition. The four Northern Ireland Labour Party MPs who were loyal opposition and who got kicked in the backside week in, week out, who were never listened to. The mere fact of government of power, the loyal opposition, does not necessarily create a liberal democracy, and we have shown it.
Right.
We have shown it.
Can you describe your vision of a kind of liberal democracy in Northern Ireland? Stable, just government?
Yes. I believe that if we can get over the present hurdles, that we can create a stable, stable administration in Northern Ireland, with hopefully a much more liberal social legislation than we have had up to now. And I think that Ireland, North and South, is going through a catharsis from stop being a peasant society on the outside western boundaries of Europe, isolated from more or less everybody else, into being a community more and more at the heart of Europe, and more and more becoming liberal democracies. I mean, the changes that have taken place, not through government, but through the people in the Republic of Ireland in the last 20 years, have been dramatic. The Republic of Ireland has also realised that it must stop whinging and solve its own problems, and it's doing it very effectively. Doing it very effectively. And that the essential requirement to get the Pope to write your constitution, or any amendments thereto, no longer exists. I think Northern Ireland is on the verge of changes which are as dramatic.
Do you
I
see
think therefore that the old civilists will be shouted louder and louder by fewer and fewer people,
including the Alliance Party.
We will hopefully be the party hopefully leading into the new radical liberal democracy of the future.
Right, okay, I'll stop it there. Thanks.
Right.